slithered off through the grass. She jumped back instinctively. Her boots caught in the undergrowth and sent her staggering. Seeking balance, her hand touched the stone face of snarling Azra, which lay broken in half. Her palm came away red and wet. Blood was welling from the cracks and splits, spilling along the rough channels of his features. She stared at her hand, horrified. This was no dream vision of guidance. The spirits were angry. She felt the dark weight of it. Events were tipping out of her control. Movement between the stones. She spun and spotted a blurred black figure a moment before it slipped out of sight. With a pang of terror, she saw several similar figures surrounding her. They stood still, unmoving, and yet they slid out of view whenever she tried to get a good look at them, moving sideways as if pulled on tracks. Each time one of them disappeared, the next appeared closer. She began to panic. She'd bridged the divide and invited the spirits through, but only some came from the Shadowlands offering knowledge. Others meant to do her harm, eager to avenge their sacred place, to take out their fury on anyone they could find. She didn't know who these strangers were, but instinct told her she should fear them. All her charms and tricks fell from her mind and she ran. The glowering faces of defiled gods loomed in the moonlight as she passed them, her patchwork cloak flapping around her. Her only chance was to get beyond the boundaries of the Dirichum and hope they wouldn't pursue. But no matter how fast she ran, the figures were faster and closing in. One rose up from the darkness in front of her. She stumbled to a halt, head buzzing, mouth dry. It was cloaked in black and wore strange armour made from material like a beetle's carapace. Its face was corpse pale, and it had no lips, only a grotesque rictus of exposed gums and fangs. Across its eyes was a band of black iron. She spun, seeking escape, but she was surrounded. Six of them pressed close, each a fresh vision of dread. One wore a net of tiny chains across its gaunt face, hooks planted in its eyelids, stretching them wide to expose the black glistening orbs beneath. Another's face had been skinned below the ridge of its cheekbones, the muscle and bone of its jaw opened out like mandibles. Yet another had forearms and fingers that had been split open and doubled in length by some diabolical surgery, which waved restlessly in the air before it. They were like the experiments of some ghoulish chimericist. The one with the visor of black iron seized her and clamped a cold hand over her eyes. A scream tore from her as everything went dark. Then it showed her what it had come here to show. Dawn found her wrapped in her cloak, staring into the fire as she drank a bowl of soup. She hadn't slept. It would have been impossible even if she had tried. The horrors of what she had seen were too fresh. She didn't understand all that the spirit had imparted, but she knew it couldn't be ignored. She needed wise counsel, and there was only one person to go to for that. By morning, she was on her way again, the ruin of the Dirichum behind her, and Ruck trotting at her side. She had her pack on her back, her staff in her hand, and for the first time in many years, a clear purpose. 12. Aaron's pickaxe struck sparks as he worked, brief splinters of light that scattered and died. He swung, drew back, and swung again in a steady rhythm. Not so fast that he'd kill himself with exertion, not so slow that he'd feel the guard's club for it. The fog of exhaustion lay thick on him, dulling the edge of his senses. His back ached, and his leaden arms throbbed at the joints. He kept on going regardless, driven by the knowledge that each blow brought him a few seconds closer to the next break, the next meal, the end of his shift. It was how the shapeless hours passed, deep in the black cold of the mountain. There were 24 of them on the detail, lined up against the wall of the tunnel, shackles around their ankles. Lanterns hung from mouldering beams, throwing fitful shadows as the men chipped away in the dark. The air was full of stone dust and the maddening echoes of metal against rock. Cade was next to him in the line, working mechanically with that dead-eyed look Aaron had come to know well. At first he'd complained bitterly about the aches and scabs and blisters, the tiredness, the near-constant hunger, but there was little sympathy for him here, and no relief. They were all in the same boat, and eventually even Aaron had tired of listening to him. Cade had stopped complaining then, and spoke a little less, and kept his pain to himself. The other prisoners liked him better after that.
"Strike harder, strike harder!"
shouted the Croden guard down the line. For some of the guards, that was all the Ossian they needed to know. Nobody looked to see who it was directed at. All they knew was that someone was flagging. If they didn't pick up the pace, they'd be beaten. Everybody got hit by the guards now and then, but it was worse when a prisoner was approaching the end of their strength. Aaron had seen two men beaten into unconsciousness for the crime of being too weak to swing a pickaxe. A third had been killed where he lay when he couldn't get up. Spurred by the warning, Aaron increased his efforts. His pickaxe barely nicked the tunnel wall with each blow, but now and then a small chunk would break off, a tiny shard of progress. A thousand of those, a thousand thousand, and the Crodans would have enough ore to extract a few drops of Ellerite. A thousand times more, and they might be able to mix enough witch iron for a breastplate or some greaves or an elaborate helmet. Eventually, at the cost of unimaginable effort and uncounted lives, they'd have enough for a suit of witch iron armour, which offered the strength of steel at a fraction of the weight. One day that armour would be worn by some mighty Harish knight, or bought by a rich earl, or gifted to foreign kings, none of whom would ever consider how it all started here, in a dark, cold tunnel in the earth, with a sliver of stone cut free. This was Aaron's life now. This was his purpose, his glorious contribution to the Croden Empire. He struck and struck again, and the sparks flared and reflected in his eyes. "I deserve this," he thought with each blow. "I deserve this. I deserve." Aaron was on slop duty that day. While his detail rested, he fetched food from the mine entrance, a task which was both a curse and a blessing. On the one hand, he was denied a break between shifts. On the other, it gave him the rare opportunity to grab an extra helping of food. He waited his turn at a blackened metal trough, where gallons of thin vegetable gruel bubbled over a bed of coals. Lamps hung from poles, casting an uneasy light over the haggard faces of the shackled men in line. The chamber was a small, dim cavern at the junction of several tunnels, and it was busy with traffic. Shabby pit ponies hauled carts full of rocks from the depths of the mine. There were guards everywhere, too, not the stern, efficient Crodans who became soldiers, but low men, glorified turnkeys and angry bullies who took every chance to vent their spite on their charges. This was far from the world the Empire showed its loyal subjects. Only the fallen saw behind the scenes. When his turn came, Aaron stood by the trough and ate, as a small handcart was filled from a chute. The fire was a comfort, and he sidled closer as he scooped gruel from his bowl with a crust of old bread. It was always cold in the mine. The dank stone leached the heat from the air, and their clothes were pitifully thin. Not even the effort of mining kept them warm. Once he'd wolfed down his meal, he held his bowl under the flow of gruel for a refill. The man at the lever didn't even look at him. As long as you finished eating before the flow was shut off, nobody cared if you took another bowlful. It was the only perk of slop duty. He pulled his handcart aside to make way, then ate his second helping with his wooden spoon, washing it down with water from his tin flask. He ate slowly this time, savouring every bite, letting the heat of the fire soak into his bones. The food was bland and watery, but as Cade used to say, hunger was the best spice. His stomach grumbled and ached, unaccustomed to being filled, but when he was done he felt as close to satisfied as he ever got these days. He hung a bag of loaves off the side of the cart and trudged away. Some prisoners on slop duty would take another chunk of bread and a bowl from the tub on their way back to their detail, but Aaron had never done that. There was never enough to go around anyway, so the other prisoners took a keen interest if the tub wasn't full when it arrived. Aaron told himself his sense of honour stopped him from giving in to temptation, but it was just as much his fear of retribution. As he left the chamber, pulling the tub behind him, he passed a wooden birdcage containing a pair of grey cave pipers. Once, the sight of them had given him a thrill of dread, but now he ignored them. It was only if they started to sing that he needed to worry. Ellerite seams bled an explosive oil under pressure, which was bad enough, but in concentrated quantities the oil gave off an invisible, odourless and flammable miasma called fire fume. It gathered in pockets, trapped beneath the earth until freed by a miner's pickaxe, when it would seep out into the tunnels until it became dense enough to ignite. The cave pipers were the only warning the miners would get. Somehow they could sense the miasma and would shriek an alarm. It gave the men some chance to escape, but not much. Well, if disaster came, it came. Aaron tried to live each day without thinking further than his bed. That was how he'd endure, until death took him, or until he and Cade were freed. It was that or give up, the way he'd seen others do. Despair gnawed a man down, first his body, then his soul, until he lost the will to live. And this was a place of despair. But that wouldn't be Aaron's fate. He was determined. He'd survive this day and the next, and he'd ensure Cade did too. There was no other option. He made his way along badly lit routes, where prisoners sat murmuring quietly or eating. He recognized some from the camp, but no one acknowledged him. No one had the energy. The handcart was heavy, and Aaron had to rest on the way back, so he pulled the cart into a darkened side corridor where no one would see it and be tempted to steal a meal. He thought he was alone until he heard a wet clicking sound and saw there were two men already here, sitting on opposite sides of the narrow tunnel. One was glaring at him with fierce eyes, mouth working restlessly as he sucked his teeth and smacked his lips. He was all skin and bone, hair in patches, features sunken. A ragweed addict. Aaron almost backed out then and there. It was best to steer clear of ragweed addicts, who could be unpredictable and violent. But something about the other man in the corridor caught his attention. He sat with his head back against the stone, eyes closed and very still. Aaron stepped away from his cart and approached him cautiously, trying to make him out in the gloom. It was nobody he recognized, but a suspicion had taken root in his mind, and he had to resolve it. He reached out slowly and placed his palm against the side of the man's face. The man's head lolled sideways, eyes open but seeing nothing. He'd died where he sat, and recently. Aaron rested on his haunches and considered the body before him. A season ago, he'd never seen a corpse. Now, the dead had lost the power to shock. They'd become part of the background of his world. He glanced about and saw nobody except the addict, who seemed disinclined to do anything but glare. Aaron shrugged at him and began to search the dead man's pockets. After all, if he didn't do it, somebody else would. The sinking sun was half hidden by the mountains as they trudged from the mine in a double line, shackles keeping their strides short, heads lowered against a bitter wind that blew flurries of icy rain down from the peaks. The summer had been punishingly hot, but the weather had turned of late, a warning of the deadly cold to come. Winter would reap them, they all knew it. The weak wouldn't see the spring. Aaron walked alongside Cade, too weary to make conversation. Guards rode with them, herding them down the trail. They carried swords and bows, alert for anyone foolish enough to run. The pine forest to their left offered the promise of sanctuary, enough to tempt the desperate. Nobody was desperate enough today. My father is dead because of me. The thought ambushed him. Randall's death was a wolf in the hollows of his mind, stalking him, savaging him with grief and loss when it could. The Iron Hand would have seized the family lands by now. Randall would be remembered as a traitor when he'd been nothing but loyal to the Empire. All because Aaron had to be with Sora. All because he hadn't listened to Harold's warning. He'd thought their wild love could overcome any obstacle, but reality had proved him wrong, and grief had doused his passion faster than he could have imagined. It was only a season since he'd seen her, a season of hard labour and sorrow, true, but a mere season all the same. Yet her memory no longer stirred him. This wasn't the storybook love he'd imagined, which conquered time and death and the meddling of the gods. He'd believed he would wither and die without her, when in truth he hardly thought of her at all. It had been a dream of love and nothing more, the stupid delusion of a callow boy. All that loss and ruin for nothing. In his darker moments it made him want to scream. He glanced at Cade. His friend looked worn. The flesh had fallen off him, his boyish pudge long gone. Though he'd always been the stronger of them, the work seemed to tax him harder than Aaron. Each day he lost a little more energy, joked less, spoke more quietly. His suffering was as much Aaron's fault as his father's death was, but with Cade at least there was some chance to atone.
"Brother Cade," growled a rum-roughened voice, and Cade stumbled as he was shoved hard from behind. Aaron saw fleeting anger cross his face, but when he turned, his mask was in place and he was smiling.
"Have you been sharpening your elbows, Rafa? You near put that one through my ribs."
Rafa gave him a tobacco-stained grin. He was a burly Carthanian pirate with a tangled black beard, his skin browned and weathered as gnarled oak.
"Do your impression of Hassan," he said. "Show my friend here."
The pockmarked man next to him leered encouragement. Cade checked that no guards were nearby. Then he swept back his shoulders, firmed his chin and puffed out his chest. No longer was he a shuffling prisoner, but a figure of pompous cruelty.
"You,"
he cried, his voice comically high as he pointed at Rafa's friend.
"Did you splash my cloak? Then where did this mud come from, hmm? To the dogs with you. To the dogs with everyone."
Rafa and his friend cackled at Cade's parody of the guard captain, and a few others nearby managed a chuckle or a grin. They all knew Hassan's obsession with cleanliness and his fondness for feeding prisoners to the dogs. Even gallows humour was welcome here, where laughter was hard to find. Aaron didn't join in. They liked Cade when he was funny, but Aaron knew how he cried to himself in his bunk every night. He performed for them because that was his nature, but it was only an act, and it drained him sorely.
"Now do Overseer Krent," urged another prisoner.
Aaron turned sharply, wearing a scowl. "He's tired," he snapped. "We're all tired. Leave him alone." Rafa slapped him round the back of the head hard.
"No one asked you," he said,
with enough casual menace to shut Aaron up.
"Easy there, you southern lunk," Cade said,
his voice now genial and friendly, hands resting on an imaginary belly and a smug smile on his face.
"No need for that. We're not on the high seas now."
Rafa's friend roared with laughter as he recognized the overseer. It was loud enough to attract the attention of a nearby guard, who yelled at them in broken Ossian to be quiet. Rafa and his friend subsided, still smirking. Cade gave Aaron an angry look. Why did you get involved? Aaron had meant to defend his friend, but he'd been the one who needed defending in the end, and defending Aaron was what had landed Cade here in the first place. Aaron wished he'd kept his silence. The pain of Rafa's blow quickly faded into the haze of other hurts. His feet were blistered from rubbing inside his boots. Every muscle ached from the day's labours, and being on slop duty meant he'd got no rest. But he had a full belly, at least. And something else, too. 6 fat cheroots, taken from the dead man, and now stashed inside his thin, ragged coat. Aaron had no idea how the prisoner had got them, but they were no use to him any more, and a lot of use to Aaron. Smokes were good currency in the camp. They followed the trail downwards, with the forest to their left and high cliffs to their right. The journey from the mine wasn't a long one. Soon they heard the river over the blowing wind and rounded a shoulder of the mountain to see their destination ahead. They called it a work camp, but it was a prison all the same. It stood on the north side of the river, sandwiched between the water and a sheer cliff face. A rough stockade surrounded it, a high wall of thick wooden stakes running out from the cliff, along the riverbank and back. Within, another stockade divided the camp into 2 sections. The smaller contained the barracks, stables, post-house, and the overseer's mansion. The larger was for the prisoners. On the far side of a dirt yard were the longhouses where they slept, arranged in uneven rows against the curve of the stockade. There was a graveyard near the cliffs, and clustered round the south gate were the buildings where luckier prisoners worked, the cookhouse, workshop, laundry, latrines and infirmary. On the other side of the river was the village of Sulla's Bluff, reached from the south gate by a stone bridge. It sat close against the forest, a drowsy settlement that now existed to serve the camp and accommodate the soldiers' families. The villagers were lighting fires against the chill of the coming night. White smoke drifted from the chimneys, whipped away by the switching wind. They'd be settling down to good meals of warm bread and meat, with ale and wine to wash it down. The prisoners gazed longingly across the river, envying their food and warmth. The village was no more than 100 paces from their prison, yet it may as well have been in another land. The trail took them via the east gate, trudging through the guard section, past the mansion where the overseer entertained his guests in his dining hall. It had been built in the strict Croden style, on the spot where the mayor's house had once stood, overlooking the river, a daily reminder to the Ossian prisoners of who held power in their land now. Aaron glowered at it as he passed, and cursed the ill luck that had him born Ossian. If he and his father had been Croden, none of this would have happened. A movement in one of the upper windows caught his eye. Someone was standing there in the last light of the dimming sun, looking down on the procession. With a jolt, Aaron recognised that bespectacled face. Clisson. Their eyes met for an instant, then the overwatchman turned away and was gone. Clisson, thought Aaron, as he huddled by the back door of the cookhouse. Was that really him? It was raining in earnest, drumming on the roofs of the longhouses and turning the ground to mud. He was free of his shackles for the night. The guards removed them once everyone was safely in the yard, but his boots let in water through the soles, and his feet were cold and soaked, which made the rubbing of his blisters worse. If only the dead man had been wearing good boots. Hugging himself for warmth, he stared through grey, wavering curtains of rain at the fence before him. It ran around the prisoner's compound, forming an inner ring of protection before the stockade itself. It was 7 feet high, easy to climb if you had the will to do it. Few did. Between the fence and the stockade lived a pack of Croden skull dogs, vicious killers who'd tear you limb from limb. Aaron could hear one now, growling and grizzling nearby. Even if you could get past them, There was a walkway on the stockade wall, patrolled by archers waiting to shoot anyone who tried to escape. Climbing that fence would be suicide. Escape was a fantasy. His thoughts circled back to Clisson again. That glimpse of him in the window had been so brief that he was tempted to doubt it. Maybe it had been a stranger who looked like him. After all, his presence made no sense. An overwatchman was the highest rank of Inquisitor, second only to the commander, head of all Iron Hand operations in Ossia. What would he be doing in a work camp in the mountains, 30 leagues from anywhere? Has he brought a reprieve? The thought flashed into his mind. Had Clisson come to right the injustice done to Aaron and Cade? After all, their crimes were paltry. Neither of them belonged here with the dissidents and rebels, the thieves and murderers. He snorted. An overwatchman riding all the way out here to pardon 2 insignificant Ossian boys. It was ridiculous. More likely he was here on some other business that had nothing to do with Aaron. That, or he'd never been there at all. Exhaustion did strange things to the mind. Best to focus on what was in front of him. Do what had to be done. Survive. The cookhouse door squealed open, and the cook's assistant, Tag, popped his freckled, horsey face out. He checked the coast was clear, then passed Aaron a small cloth bag. It was suspiciously light, so Aaron opened it and saw 3 cheese rolls inside. They were mean fare, a bit of old cheddar mashed into a ball of rough bread, but under the circumstances it was a feast.
"You said 4, he told Tag. 3 was all I could get, said Tag, looking affronted. "And it's my neck on the block here, take it or sod off."
Aaron had the suspicion he was being cheated, but he was in no position to bargain. With a scowl, he drew out 2 cheroots from his inner pocket. Tag snatched them off him.
"Pleasure doing business," he said, and nipped back inside.
Aaron stashed one of the rolls in his pocket and put the bag under his shirt. Then he scampered to the side of the cookhouse and peered round the corner. The foul weather kept most of the guards inside, but he still needed to be careful. If he was caught with contraband, he'd suffer for it. He saw nobody but other prisoners, so he crossed the road that led from the yard to the south gate and slipped away between the buildings. He caught up with Jan as he was leaving the laundry. Jan had a lazy eye and a ready smile, and whether by luck or by craft, he'd got himself on laundry duty 5 days a week, cleaning clothes for the guards. He was pushing a wooden trolley full of sacks and covered with an oilcloth, the end of which he'd pulled over his head to keep dry. He stopped pushing as he saw Aaron come hurrying up.
"Got something for me?" he asked.
Aaron held out the bag. 2 cheese rolls, fresh as they come." Jan took the bag, rummaged under the oilcloth, and pulled out a rolled-up pair of socks. They were made of thick wool and, as far as Aaron could see, hardly worn.
"Fresh as they come," Jan said with a wink.
A bell clanged somewhere in the gloom, the last bell before curfew.
"Better get on," said Jan.
Aaron gave him a nod, and they went their separate ways, Jan pushing his trolley, Aaron towards the longhouses. He felt his heart lighten a little as he hurried through the splattering rain. Fortune had smiled on him. He might be wet and cold and tired, but he had 4 cheroots, a cheese roll, and a pair of good socks. Days rarely came better than this in the camp at Sulla's Bluff. The longhouse was rank with stale sweat. The scent had seeped into the ratty blankets and permeated the thin plank walls, and no amount of airing would remove it. Prisoners shuffled between the narrow packed bunks by the light of a single lantern, faces hollowed by shadow. Many had gone straight to sleep after returning from the mine. One man near the door had the kind of cough that wouldn't shift, and the sound of it quietened those around him. They recognized the herald of death, and it sobered them. Aaron, sodden with rain, sidled down the aisle, past loitering prisoners who hadn't yet gone to their bunks. He was headed for the far end, where the glow of the lantern barely reached. When he got there, he found Cade already in bed, lying fully clothed on top of his blankets, and staring vacantly at the underside of Aaron's bunk. He squatted down beside him. The men nearby were asleep, sighing and snoring, so Aaron said his name quietly. Cade kept staring blankly upwards until Aaron shook his shoulder, and he jerked as if shocked from a daze. When he saw Aaron, he looked vaguely disappointed. "I brought you a cheese roll," said Aaron, "and some good thick socks." He slipped them under the corner of Cade's pillow, making sure no one else saw. "Days are getting colder. You'll need them." "Thanks," muttered Cade, but there was no gratitude in it. It was just a word without emotion. Aaron tried not to be irritated by that. He'd expected at least a little warmth as acknowledgement of his efforts. He could have kept the socks for himself. "Put the socks on after lights out, or someone will take them. And eat that roll tonight, you need it."
"Aye, I'll do that," Cade said absently, and went back to staring at the underside of Aaron's bunk.
His manner was beginning to make Aaron concerned. He laid a hand on his friend's shoulder.
"What is it?"
Cade snorted.
"I don't know, Aaron. What could it possibly be?" he asked sarcastically, waving to indicate their surroundings.
"I know it's bad right now," said Aaron, "but I'll look out for you. We just have to hang on."
"Hang on for what?"
"Till they let us out." Cade turned his head slowly towards Aaron, face slack with disbelief.
"Is that what you think? They'll let us out?"
Aaron was taken aback by his reaction. "Well, yes. Once they realized my father was no traitor. Sora's father and the governor set him up, you know that as well as I do. Crodan justice is renowned for its rigor and fairness. It's not like the old corrupt Ossian courts. The truth will come to light, Cade. I'm sure of it."
Cade raised himself up on his elbows. "You know Bard, right? The lad who works on the graves? Been here 11 years. You know what he did? Bad-mouthed the Empress when he was drunk. That's all. Gavan, the quartermaster's assistant, he was the son of a lord. They put him in here for owning a banned book. 6 years now. Jotry, on our detail, he don't even know what he did. They just took him away."
He was hissing with anger now. Aaron had never seen him like that before.
"So let me ask you again. What are we hanging on for?"
"Because..." Aaron fought for an answer.
"Because it's not over. Because we're still alive."
He grew stern.
"Don't give up on me, Cade."
Cade's face tightened with scorn.
"You still reckon everything's going to be all right, don't you? Still believe in their system. Keep playing the game, keep pretending to be Crodan, and all this will come undone."
He looked Aaron square in the eye.
"It ain't going to happen. They'll never let us out of here. And your da will always be dead."
Aaron was stunned by the unexpected cruelty of that.
"My da was right about you," Cade snarled. "You're a lost cause. They took everything you had, and you're still a God's damn Crodan lover."
He rolled over, showing his back to Aaron. And after that, there was nothing more to say. 13.
"I hate him."
Cade tried on the idea for size. Wasn't sure it sat right. Da always said a bad workman blamed his tools. Take responsibility for yourself, that was what he meant. Aaron never asked for his help. No one made him stand in that Crodan soldier's way. But nine, how he wished he hadn't. It was a bleak morning on the yard, but they were all out in it, bellies rumbling and scalps itchy with lice and grime. A line of guards stood in front of them, swords drawn and eager for trouble. The archers on the walkway that ringed the compound had arrows nocked and ready to pull. On the far side of the yard was a tall wooden post, stained with old blood and deep scratches. Degan was tied there. Degan with the missing front teeth he'd sold to a dollmaker for gambling money. He was lisping his way through a frantic prayer to Sala, the red-eyed child, Lady of Worms. Cade reckoned he'd be better served directing his prayers to Og, Aspect of Beasts. Maybe Og could do something about those two slavering skull dogs straining at their leashes, desperate to get at him. Captain Hassan walked up and down before the ranked guards, addressing the prisoners. He was a big man with thick, dark brows and eyes set too close together, making him look simple. His voice was reedy and cut to the nerve, just as shrill as Cade's had been when he parodied him yesterday. Small wonder he was angry all the time with a voice like that.
"Rules," he cried as he stalked back and forth. "We have rules here, and they are very clear. Rules are all that separate you from the animals."
His Ossian was good, even if his accent wasn't. He still made the guttural back of the throat sound which Crodans scattered throughout their speech. Cade had never understood Aaron's love for their language. Ossian sentences glided like birds. The Crodan tongue sounded harsh and ugly to his ears, like being hit with a mailed fist.
"But the rules mean nothing if they are not enforced," Hassan went on. "And this man broke the rules, bribed a villager to help smuggle him out. Bad luck for him that this villager was a loyal servant of the Empire."
A collaborator, then, thought Cade with distaste. They'd sold out a fellow Ossian for fear of being implicated in a crime. Dar used to say the Iron Hand sometimes set people up that way, using Ossians to catch out their countryfolk, tempt them into doing something illegal, then swoop. You never knew who to trust these days. That was how the squareheads liked it. He stopped listening as Hassan ranted on. He'd heard it all before. How could Ossians be trusted if they couldn't follow the rules? If punishment was all they understood, then punishment they'd have. Like he was talking to naughty children, like he was so damn superior. Cade was done with all that. "I hate him." But he didn't. He couldn't. Aaron had been his friend for years. They'd had their arguments, even brawled a few times, but in the way of boys, it was always forgotten in the morning, with no need for apologies. Aaron had been as loyal and unfaltering as anyone could wish for. Cade just needed someone else to blame for all this misery, because the alternative was to blame himself. What madness had made him stand up to a Crodan soldier like that? What had he hoped to achieve? He'd thought on that question a lot in those first terrible days, but he'd arrived at no answer in the end. Perhaps he'd taken leave of his senses. Perhaps he was sick of the Crodans looming over his world, sick of submitting, the way he'd been forced to submit all his life. Or perhaps it was the thought of losing Aaron, the one thing in his small-town life that wasn't mundane, the only other person who dreamed of adventure and excitement beyond Shoal Point. Or maybe it was just because Aaron was his friend, and Cade stood up for his friends, even if it wasn't always the brightest thing to do. And look where that got you. Overseer Krent stood at a safe distance from the dogs, his belly stretching his dark uniform jacket and a bearskin cloak across his shoulders. He looked permanently pleased with himself, a half-smile on his lips, like a man well-sated after a feast. The face he wore to an execution was the same face he wore when he led prayers to the Primus on Festan Day, or when he assembled the prisoners to announce some new triumph in the Empire.
"There is no escape from this camp," Hassan was saying. "Beyond these walls you would find cold welcome. The villagers will not help you. The road is constantly patrolled. Mountain and forest surround us, and if our dogs do not kill you, the weather or starvation surely will."
He swept out a hand to indicate the skull dogs, as if everybody hadn't already noticed them. Two burly handlers held them back as they snapped and snarled. The dogs were thickly built, their blunt muzzles packed with fangs. They had short black fur on their bodies and round their eyes, but white fur on their heads, giving them the skull-like mask they were named for. Croden skull dogs were man-hunters, bred for the kill. It was said they could smell Ossian blood and hungered for it, but Cade doubted that. Ossia and Croda had been neighbours for centuries, and they'd mixed together plenty. Despite the gulf of language and belief, the only real difference between Ossian and Croden stock was that Ossians tended to darker hair and brown or green eyes, while Crodans tended to blonde and blue. Even then, it was hard to tell them apart if you took away the clothes and the language and the mannerisms. Aaron was dark-haired but could have passed as Croden. He knew their ways so well. Cade was blonde but as Ossian as they came. The Crodans acted like they were a separate species, but underneath they were just the same. It was more likely the dogs were trained to attack anyone in prisoner's clothes. Degan whimpered and prayed louder, barely able to get the words out through his fear. Cade watched without emotion. Who cared if he died? Cade had his own problems. He'd never see his parents again, and he missed his ma something fierce. His friends would have forgotten him already. Once, he'd lamented a life trapped in Shoal Point, damned to his father's workshop. What he'd give to have that back now. Every morning, when he woke, there was a moment of disorientation before he remembered where he was. In that moment, he could briefly believe he was back in his bed at home, with the smell of breakfast wafting up from downstairs, and the coastal sun shining through the curtains. Then reality would hit him, and he knew the mine awaited, and he wanted to die. Sometimes he thought he could extinguish himself by sheer force of will, but no matter how hard he tried, he just kept on living. There was only the misery of toil, and no end to it.
"Sala, Lady of Worms, have mercy on me!"
Degan pleaded with the aspects, but not with his captors. He knew better than that. Hassan professed false remorse, telling him he'd brought his fate upon himself. Krent showed genial indifference, as if this were an after-dinner speech and not the prelude to the agonizing murder of a human being. Cade wasn't sure which was worse. "Here's Croden justice. Are you watching, Aaron?" Of course he was. And he probably had some mud-mouthed excuse for the slaughter to come. Something about how Ossians needed discipline and examples had to be made. Cade had been able to turn a deaf ear to that talk when they were back home, but he wouldn't suffer it now. Maybe Aaron couldn't bring himself to blame the squareheads for what happened, but Cade could, for all the good it did him. "I'll look out for you," Aaron had said, but Cade didn't want looking out for, didn't need it. He was tired of Aaron's relentless encouragement, angry at the mulish way he plodded into the future, dragging Cade with him. Every gift he gave Cade was a small atonement, another pebble tossed into the bottomless pit of his guilt. Each one a reminder that they were no longer the inseparable friends who'd run riot through the stone lanes of Shoal Point, who'd fought Drakens and Ogryn, stormed imaginary castles and flirted with the local girls. In some vague way that he couldn't articulate, he sensed he'd become Aaron's redemption. Aaron wanted to save him, but there was no getting out of this place, and Cade knew it. Degan's prayers became screams as Hassan gave the signal and the dogs were released. Cade watched them do their work, but it all seemed like it was happening at some far distance to a stranger, and he didn't feel a thing. 14. After the execution came breakfast. Even after what they'd just seen, none of the prisoners was inclined to turn it down. They formed four lines across the yard and filed towards the cookhouse, where tureens of soup and baskets of bread had been laid out on a long table. When either time or food ran out, they'd be off to the mine. The execution had put everything behind schedule, and Crodans were fastidious timekeepers, so the prisoners jostled and urged those ahead of them to be quick. When the next bell rang, those who hadn't been served would go hungry. It always paid to be near the front of the line at breakfast time. Aaron's stomach churned, and not only from hunger, he seethed with fury. He'd hardly slept last night, despite the tiredness weighing down his bones. He was too angry. He wanted to lash out but had nowhere to strike, so the rage stayed trapped inside him, heating his thoughts to violence. Cade had wounded him. He hadn't thought a simple insult could ever cut so deep. They'd traded hard words before, but these had poison in them, and they festered. They felt like a betrayal. His father was dead, his love for Sora proven false. The last true thing he had was Cade, a friend so stout and brave he'd stood up to the Iron Hand to defend him. It was the kind of selfless loyalty that Aaron dreamed of possessing, the kind of sacrifice that made stories. It was the most heroic thing he'd ever seen. He'd hoped to repay Cade somehow, to support him through this terrible time, to be his strength when he needed it. But Cade had thrown it back in his face. When Aaron reached the front of the queue, he found Tag serving him. Tag gave him a wry smile, a generous helping of soup, and one of the bigger pieces of bread. He'd enjoyed his cheroots then. Perhaps this was his thank you, or a form of apology for shorting him on the cheese rolls. The man behind was hurrying him on, so he took his bowl and bread and scuttled quickly out of the yard. It wasn't wise to eat breakfast in the open, where bigger men might take it from him, and he had more than his hunger to attend to this morning. The remaining cheroots were still in his ragged coat. There had been no time to hide them last night, and only fools kept their stash in the longhouses, which were searched by guards and light-fingered prisoners alike. Carrying them around was dangerous, for if he was caught with them, he'd be beaten hard. That meant he had to put them somewhere safe and quick. He had a likely spot in mind, a hollowed-out space behind a loose brick in the foundations of the workshop. He'd found it by accident several days ago, full of spiders and long abandoned. Whoever made it had probably died. He'd intended to take the cheroot straight there before breakfast, but Degan's execution put paid to that. The south gate had been opened, and several horse-drawn carts were making their way across the bridge and into the camp, accompanied by a few dozen Ossian villagers on foot. There were cleaners and servants and messengers with post, carpenters for repairs and butchers bringing meat, all of them heading for the guard section of the camp, where the Crodans lived in relative comfort. On their way, they passed the bloody mass of torn flesh that had once been Degan, still tied to the pole. Those that looked at all couldn't look upon him for long. As he left the yard, Aaron spotted Rafa standing near the gate, where the carts were being searched. The pirate didn't trouble to queue for breakfast. He had other sources and access to better food. Aaron watched closely as a cart approached the gates, and a look passed between Rafa and the Crodan guard on duty. The guard gave the cart a cursory once over and waved it through. The driver, clearly in on the game, rolled by without so much as a glance at the guard or the pirate. Rumour had it that Rafa had plenty of coin on the outside from his raiding days, having once captured a galleon sailing under the colours of the Barrack League, loaded to the gunwales with enough gold to make 100 men rich. Enough that his cohorts could grease a few palms, anyway. Enough that he could smuggle in luxuries and put a few guards in his pocket. If a prisoner wanted something that couldn't be got, Rafa could help. For a price. Aaron scowled at the thought of the scene he'd just witnessed. It was supposed to be Ossians who were weak-willed by nature, given to corruption, unfit for positions of responsibility. Crodans kept strict records, punished underhand behaviour, and employed checks and balances to ensure their officials stayed honest. And yet here were Crodan guards turning a blind eye to a smuggler in return for coin, and barely bothering to hide it. Perhaps their system wasn't so flawless after all. He shied away from that idea. It felt like blasphemy. The actions of a few low men didn't define an empire. Such thoughts were the work of the Nemesis, enemy of the Primus, bringer of chaos. They took everything you had, and you're still a goddamn Croden lover. He saw Cade's face again as he said it, hateful in the gloom of his bunk. Croden lover. It was an easy insult for an Ossian to throw. Croden lover. Yes, he admired them, of course he did. He couldn't so easily undo his understanding of the world. He'd grown up surrounded by them, speaking their language, learning their lore. Some, like Nanny Elsa and Sora, had been dear to him. They lived in an occupied land, that was the reality. He'd rather deal with that than stay tangled in the past, mooning over forgotten ruins and hanging on to old traditions and out-of-date ideas. Ossia was no longer as it had been in their grandparents' day. The aspects had waned, and order had replaced chaos. He didn't understand why anyone would reject diligence, discipline, and learning just because it came from a foreign source. It was the knee-jerk reaction of the ignorant when threatened with change. Cade said the Crodans had killed Randall, and that should be reason enough for Aaron to hate them. But he couldn't swallow that. A Croden had killed him, yes, but his hand had been forced. After all, Randall had killed several soldiers first. "Why did you fight back, Father? Why didn't you just surrender? A judge would have found you innocent. None of this need ever have happened." No, and none of it would have, if he'd listened to Harold's warning and stayed away from Sora. He shook himself from his reverie. This wasn't the time. If he was quick, he could stash the cheroots and still manage to eat his breakfast before the bell summoned the prisoners to be shackled and marched to the mine. Holding his bowl of cooling soup in one hand and his bread in the other, he hurried towards the workshop. Tag's generous portion had almost filled the bowl to the brim, and Aaron had to concentrate to avoid spilling it. He was so focused on his task that he didn't see the man step out from behind a longhouse into his path. A thump of colliding bodies, a momentary tangle of limbs, and Aaron found himself flat on his back, his bowl overturned, and his bread in the mud beside him. The prisoner he'd walked into had barely been rocked by the impact. Aaron's heart sank as he saw who it was. "Grub been looking for you," he said. He was squat, broad and ugly, with a wide, squashed nose, a heavy brow and the sly, surly face of a thug. Tattoos crawled all over one side of his face, across his shaven skull, down his throat to his chest. They covered his left arm to the fingertips, and Aaron could only guess how much more of him was inked. It was the work of a master, a thorny mesh of foreign hieroglyphs and stylized pictures rendered in exquisite detail, ebbing and flowing across the skin. The only blot was the crescent of pure black arcing from cheek to cheek, across his eyelids and the bridge of his nose. That was clumsy and slapdash, marring the art on the left side of his face, as if added in by another hand, without regard for what had been there before. He was a Skarl, from the frozen lands to the northeast of Embria, across the Barrack Sea. He was also a bully and a brute, and he'd been Aaron's enemy from the day he arrived. "I see man from cookhouse smoking cheroots," said Grub, in clunking Ossian. "Grub likes cheroots. Cookhouse man say they come from you. Where you get cheroots, little mudslug?" Suddenly, Tag's unexpected generosity made sense. It had been an apology. Much good it did Aaron, with his breakfast drooling away into the dirt. "I found them," he said, raising himself up on his elbows.
"You found them. Where are they now?"
"I traded them." Aaron began to get up, but Grub put a boot on his chest and shoved him back down. Furiously, Aaron tried to surge to his feet, but Grub kicked away his supporting hand and he crashed back to the mud. Aaron glared at him, red-faced, breathing hard, enraged but unable to do anything about it. Grub pulled up his sleeve, pointed to his tattooed forearm with one thick finger.
"See this? It say Grub killed 15 men in one battle.
saved his wounded companion. His finger moved to another cluster of pictograms. See this? This Segrab was attacked by Ice Bear on Glacier. Ice Bear end up pretty sorry when Grab turned him into tasty steaks.
Aaron seethed with frustration. He wanted to get up to throw a punch, but Grub would just knock him down again. He was heavy with brawn where Aaron was scrawny. Grub worked on the graves, so he always had dead men's clothes to trade for food. He labored little and ate well.
You not keep things from Grub, eh? Grub great warrior. Grub wiped better than you off his arse.
Aaron felt a sneer of defiance spread across his face. Picking on someone half your weight for some tired old cheroots. You must be a great warrior.
Grub kicked him across the face.
Aaron turned away at the last moment, so it was a glancing blow, but it still near broke his cheekbone and set stars exploding behind his eyes.
Your mouth smarter than your head, Grub told him darkly.
Aaron spat blood into the dirt.
I don't have any cheroots, he mumbled.
That's true, said Grub, holding up a handful of them. You don't.
Aaron stared. His hand went to his coat pocket. The cheroots were gone. The skull showed him a mouthful of crooked teeth and brandished his prizes.
See these? He said. They say Grub damn good pickpocket.
He booted Aaron hard in the gut, knocking the wind from him.
That for holding out on me, mudslug. I see you soon.
Aaron was still wretched and gasping in the dirt when a distant bell called him to another day of pointless, grueling toil. Aching, battered, he picked himself up, inch by painful inch, until he was back on his feet again. The side of his face felt enormous. His head was light, one eye was swelling shut, and his back was cold and soaked with mud. He clutched his ribs and shuffled off towards the yard. Survive today. That was all he had to do. Survive. 15.
Strike harder! Strike harder!
Aaron attacked the tunnel wall with his pickaxe. His sore ribs stabbed him with every swing. His arms and back ached. His skin shone with sweat in the lantern light. The left side of his face had swollen up and was patched with ugly blues and purples, painful in parts, thick and numbed in others. The guard had noticed his bruises and was looking for signs that he was slacking. Aaron gave him nothing. He swung at the rock like it was Grub before him, as if he was burying the point of the pickaxe in the tattooed skull's forehead. Finally the guard grunted, finding no fault to punish, and moved on down the line, his wooden club dangling loosely in his hand. Cade was somewhere near the other end. They were working apart for the first time since they'd arrived. It was impossible to avoid each other entirely, since Aaron's bunk was above his, but they hadn't spoken since last night. Cade had seen Aaron's injuries when he reached the yard for shackling, but he'd made no comment. Aaron, for his part, was determined not to break the silence. Cade had wronged him, not the other way around. It was up to Cade to offer the hand of reconciliation. The guard had gone by now, but Aaron didn't let up. He swung again and again, putting all his frustration and anger into each blow.
"Ease up,"
whispered the prisoner next to him in line. His name was Hendry, a gaunt, malnourished man with unshaven cheeks, much like 100 others here.
"You'll not last the day."
Aaron ignored him. He knew overexertion was foolish. He hadn't eaten any breakfast, and if he fainted, he'd be beaten or killed. It didn't matter. He couldn't stop. All the grief and rage and pain had to go somewhere. It was too much to contain.
"Strike harder!"
So he struck, teeth gritted and eyes afire, again, again, again. With a crunch and a jolt, the stone split beneath his pick. A sliver of black rock the length of his forearm fell away and thudded to the ground. Aaron stopped swinging, chest heaving, and stared at what he'd done. Ellerite,
hid inside the hardest rock. They'd battered this wall for a season, making progress in chips and pebbles. The chunk Aaron had knocked free would have taken weeks to dig out. The men to either side gathered in and gazed at the wound Aaron had made in a wall that had previously seemed invulnerable. Dusted across the black rock, faintly lustrous in the lantern light, were fat grey flecks of Ellerite, more than they'd ever seen in their lives. Aaron's detail were moved out of the tunnel while the engineers were called in to investigate. If a new seam of Ellerite had been found, plans had to be drawn up to exploit it, and they needed to assess the danger of Ellerite oil seeping out and flammable vapours building up. Aaron and the others were dumped in a side tunnel pending reassignment, with nothing to do but sit and rest for the remainder of the day under the watch of a bored guard. For the prisoners, it was as good as a holiday, and spirits were high. Some of the prisoners clapped Aaron on the shoulder, praising him for their good fortune. Hendry told everyone how Aaron had attacked the wall like a demon, how he was stronger than he looked. Cade stayed sullen and avoided his eye. He seemed even angrier than before, as if Aaron had purposely made himself the hero of the hour just to spite him. Aaron accepted the thanks of his grinning workmates and forced himself to be merry and join in with their talk. A grim face would win him no friends, no matter what he felt inside. But in those moments when he found himself alone, his thoughts turned to darker things, and his fingers strayed to his bruised face as he began to plot his revenge. An autumn fog had settled by the time their shift ended, and they were led back to the camp through a dank grey haze, a line of shadows filing through the murk. There were mutterings about making a break for the forest. The weather was perfect for it. But Aaron heard no cry of alarm, and when they were counted and unshackled in the yard, nobody was missing. It was chain day, and that meant the bathhouse. They were sent there by detail, then made to strip and climb into a communal bath of freezing water piped from the river. Aaron's detail was early, so the water was still relatively clear. Later, it would be brown and scummed with filth. He scrubbed himself and shivered, the caustic soap burning his eyes and stinging in every cut and scrape, his injuries throbbing in the cold. All around him were pale, naked men made pitiful by starvation and overwork. 3 months and more had taken some of the meat from Aaron and Cade, but those who'd been here longer seemed only held together by their skin. "They could feed us properly if they wanted," said a treacherous voice in his mind. "But they know there will be more coming. Cheaper to use us up. We are called prisoners, but this is no sentence. This is a long, slow execution." Even that morning such thoughts would have made him afraid, as if the Primus or the Iron Hand might hear and visit greater punishment upon him. Normally he'd have argued with that voice, fought back with the wisdom of his tutors or his father, quoted from the Acts of Thomas and Toven. But anger had made him sullen and defiant, and he dared to listen to it now. After the bath, they collected their clothes and hurried back to their longhouse to wrap themselves in blankets and warm up. Aaron didn't go with them. He took station round the corner, within sight of the entrance, and waited with his arms about himself and his teeth chattering. The fog helped to hide him as the other details came and went, cursing and beating themselves against the chill. From beyond the fence, he could hear the muted barks of the skull dogs that patrolled the border of the prisoner's compound. They were silenced by an eerie wail from the peaks, the cry of something forlorn that made Aaron's skin creep. He was reminded of Cade's stories, of things that haunted forgotten places where the divide was not so wide and the shadowlands drew near. But he had no faith in stories today. It was probably just a wild animal. Three details passed through the bathhouse door before Aaron saw the man he was looking for.
He'd grown skilled at spotting Grubb after so long attempting to avoid him, and knew him in the fog by his bald head, squat body and lumbering gait. Once he'd seen Grubb go in, he drew back and waited for him to emerge again, teeth clenched to still his juddering jaw. He knew he risked catching a chill, and a chill could kill you in this place, but it was a risk he'd take. Cold as he was warmed by the fires of fury. He meant to reclaim what was his, and more besides. Grubb worked on the graves. Aaron knew that much about him. It was someone's idea of a joke, perhaps. Skarls were a people obsessed with death, who lived among the towering tombs of their ancestors in frosty necropolises, and worshipped a deity they called the Bone God. Grave work was highly sought after in the camp, for whenever there was burying to be done, the gravediggers were excused the mine, and they had the pick of whatever the dead were carrying. Boots and clothes wore out fast, and corpses had no use for them, so gravediggers always had something to trade. With Degan's execution that morning, the gravediggers had stayed in the camp to work while the others went to the mine. Grubb would have had plenty of time to stash the cheroots he took from Aaron, but little opportunity to smoke them, not unless he wanted to share them or risk the attention of the guards. No, a smart man would keep them safe until the hour before lights out, and then sneak away to enjoy them alone, somewhere deserted where nobody would be drawn by the smell of tobacco. Grubb's coat was thick enough that he'd have no need to scurry back to his bunk to warm up after his bath. Besides, he'd boasted that Ossian cold was a summer's day to a Skarl. So, unless Aaron missed his guess, Grubb would head straight for his stash. Every prisoner had a secret place where they kept everything they didn't want stolen, and Aaron was betting Grubb's was bulging with goods he'd taken from the dead. Aaron would follow him right to it and rob him of everything he had. Grubb was one of the first out of the bathhouse. Aaron detached himself from his hiding place and slipped in among the others, keeping his eyes on his quarry. If anyone in the group noticed an unfamiliar face in the fog, they were too keen on getting back to their longhouse to care. Aaron stayed with them as they hustled through muddy alleys, the fog turning the camp into a dreamlike netherworld of smeared lights and flurrying shades. The men around him clapped their hands and hugged themselves, huffing clouds of steamy breath. After a time, Grubb stepped away from the group, so quickly and smoothly that Aaron almost missed him leaving. Aaron felt a small triumph at predicting his opponent. "You must think three moves ahead," he heard Master Fasten say. "Know your intention before you act." He gave Grubb a moment's head start, then followed him through the clutter of longhouses, where lanterns glowed dim and blurred from square windows. They passed furtive prisoners, taking advantage of the weather to carry out secret business, but Aaron paid them no mind. The Skarl was a barely visible silhouette ahead of him, fading in and out of his vision. It was hard to keep him in sight, but Aaron dared not get too close in case he was spotted. If Grubb caught him, he'd put him in the infirmary, or worse. They reached the northern end of the longhouses, where a strip of bare stony ground and a drifting wall of grey awaited them. Grubb headed into it without hesitation, and Aaron went after him. It was only a few dozen paces from the edge of the longhouses to the graveyard, but once out of sight of the buildings, the distance seemed to expand, and Aaron suddenly became afraid. With no walls to define his position, the emptiness became oppressive and endless. He felt vulnerable, exposed and adrift. It was only a matter of moments, but it was enough to set Aaron's heart racing, for panic to tighten his chest. Then, to his relief, crooked lines darkened ahead of him, and he saw a low, rickety fence, the border of the graveyard. He reached the fence, clutched it with both hands as if anchoring himself, and took a few deep breaths. What was that? He thought. What just happened? The nameless fear had taken him by surprise. Was it exhaustion? Lack of food or something deeper?
He realized with a jolt that grub was nowhere in sight. He could see nothing beyond the fence but the leaning shadows of grave markers.
I've lost him.
He forced himself to be calm. Shivering, heart drumming against his ribs, he listened. A soft rustle came from somewhere ahead, so quiet that it could have been his imagination. He climbed the low fence and went in search of the sound. Any direction was better than none. Small, knotty shrubs and twisted trees grew in the hollows, giant hag's claws reaching from the gloom. He knew the graveyard was little more than an enclosure at the foot of the cliffs, but it was large, and the ground was bumpy and treacherous, swollen with the remains of the dead. Grave markers surrounded him. Some were simple planks jammed in the earth with a name carved into them. Others were crude cairns of piled stones. The dead who got markers were the lucky ones, those with friends who cared enough to leave something. Most went unremembered. Something flew at his face. Instinctively, he threw up his hands, and he tripped backwards and crashed to the earth as a thrashing, flurrying shape burst through the air above him. Then it was gone into the fog, flapping and croaking, and he knew it for what it was. A startled crow, nothing more. He picked himself up, muttering in anger and clutching his ribs, which hurt anew from the fall. He wiped a hand across his swollen lip, it had been dribbling all day, and looked about. He wasn't sure which direction the crow had come from, or which direction he was now facing. A glimpse of the cliff and he could have orientated himself, but the clutching fog thwarted him. Grub was long gone. If he found his quarry now, it would be pure luck, and it was just as likely the skull would find Aaron instead, and that wouldn't end well. He was freezing and injured, and all sense told him to give up. But Aaron wasn't easily dissuaded, no matter how sensible the argument, so he struck out blindly across the graveyard. If luck was all he had, then he might as well trust himself to it. He jogged as fast as he dared between the grave markers, wary of turning an ankle on the uneven ground. The fog muffled sound and foiled echoes, but he heard the rustle of crows nearby, the tap of stone on stone as a cairn settled, the hissing of the breeze off the river. A bell tolled, the last before lights out. Aaron fixed the direction in his mind as best he could. That way lay the longhouses, and he could navigate from that. He turned to head for the graveyard's centre, but suddenly his foot went from under him, and he skidded down to one knee as the earth gave way and almost sent him toppling into an empty grave. He pulled his leg out, shuffled a few yards on his arse, and leaned against a pile of displaced earth. Think, he told himself sternly as he caught his breath. Don't just run about. Think. As he was racking his brain, he saw a quick movement in the fog. A crow had hopped up onto a nearby grave marker. It strutted along the top of the plank, head jerking this way and that, one beady eye on Aaron as it searched for worms. Plenty of worms here, Aaron thought bitterly. And then it came to him. The cheroot. If grub was coming here to smoke, then Aaron would be able to smell it. It was just a matter of finding his scent. Inspired, he was about to get to his feet when there was a muted thump, and the crow disappeared. Aaron froze. A few feathers seesawed to the ground in the spot where the bird had stood. He rose slowly into a crouch. The fog felt heavy with threat as he crept towards a tall cairn and peered around it. The crow lay motionless on the ground in a tangle of wings. He was about to move closer when he heard something that filled him with dread. Out in the fog, he could hear singing. The voice was high and thin and quiet, and the words were in no language he knew, a sibilant trilling tongue that drifted half-whispered from the white void. It sounded like a lullaby or a children's rhyme, but here among the dead it became the sinister lure of some catcher spirit, a shade that had crossed the divide to hunt the living. Cade's stories flooded into his head of will-o'-the-wisps and trickster phantoms that drew lonely travellers to a dire fate. He dared not run for fear of attracting it, so he stayed where he was, hunkered behind the cairn, and prayed the owner of that voice wouldn't find him. Something scurried between the graves, a jumble of limbs partly seen, a creature like a spider but almost as big as he was. An instant later it was lost in the fog again, but still the song went on, a haunting melody at the limit of his hearing, now hummed, now keened, now hissed on a breath. "Primus, keep me," he begged silently, helpless before the terror of the supernatural. "Primus, protect me." It scuttled from the fog, running low, and it was no longer a spider, but something that wore the shape of a boy, a puny, tattered boy of 12 or 13. He had long, shaggy hair, and wore a motley of ragged coats that disguised his shape. He carried a leather thong in one hand, trailing on the ground behind him. A sling. He'd taken down the crow with a stone. A boy, then, not a monster. And yet his presence here was so bizarre that Aaron couldn't bring himself to believe it. Spirits took the skins of children. Sala herself was said to appear as a hairless girl with bright red irises, wearing a black cowled robe. So he stayed where he was and made no sound. The boy crouched next to the crow, picked it up with both hands, and as his song came to an end, he sank his teeth into its breast. Aaron gasped, too loud. The boy looked up, directly at him, blood and feathers stuck to his chin. Aaron's heart almost stopped as he was fixed with a pair of shockingly green eyes. He bolted, running as fast and as hard as he could. He flew through the graveyard, driven by horror, expecting to be seized by some unknown force at any moment and snatched away. Vaulting the fence around the graveyard, he sprinted for his longhouse. It was only once he lay panting in his bunk that he began to believe the wild creature hadn't pursued him, and that he was, for the moment, safe. 16. Cade wasn't in his bunk to see Aaron return from the graveyard. He was standing outside the door of a different longhouse, hovering uneasily in the fog, half ready to enter and half ready to walk away. 3 times his courage had swelled, 3 times it had failed him, before his hand touched the wood. He shuffled his feet and cursed, but didn't go in. A figure emerged from the murk, a pinch-faced prisoner called Jeb. Cade was caught standing before the door, dithering like a fool. Jeb walked past him and pushed the door open with a scowl, as Cade, flustered and embarrassed, turned to leave. "You coming, then?" Jeb asked. He was holding the door open. "Get a move on, I'm letting the fog in." There was nothing Cade could do but go inside. It was a longhouse much like his own, inadequately lit and crammed with rows of bunks. But here there were strangers lying in the bunks, playing cards and idling in the aisles, and he was an intruder. Their gazes felt unfriendly as he made his way between the beds. He waited to be challenged, for some brawny arm to bar his way and prisoners to close in around him. No challenge came. A few watched him with bored curiosity, then went back to what they were doing. None of them cared who he was or what he was doing there. For once, Cade was glad nobody paid him any attention. At the end of the longhouse, the bunks had been rearranged to form a den, some pushed to the walls and others turned sideways as a barrier. Several men lounged at the entrance, blocking the aisle. They were better fed than the other prisoners, bigger and stronger, and they had the surly alertness of hired muscle. One of them was the man he'd performed for yesterday, when he'd made fun of Hassan and Krent. A grin split his pockmarked face, and he leaned back and called into the den. "Rafa, it's the funny lad." He turned eager-eyed to Cade. "Do Hassan again." "To the dogs with everyone," he screeched in a poor attempt to copy Cade's impression. Then he cackled. "Degan would have loved that." "Let him by, brother," came the pirate's growling voice from the gloom of the den. "He's here for business, not to dance for you." The man stood aside, still grinning, and Cade slid past.
Inside, the den was only a few paces wide. Three men sat on the bunks that formed the walls. One was up on the top bunk, leaning forward with his legs dangling and his face in shadow, a dark watchman overseeing those below. Rafa sat in a battered armchair, leafing through letters. Here, where Cade had thought no such luxuries existed, it might as well have been a throne.
"You read, brother?"
Rafa asked, without looking up. "Slowly," Cade said. Rafa sighed and squinted at the letter in his hand.
"Me too. Between my slow reading and their bad writing, seems I spend half my day at this."
They? Who were they?
"Don't speak Carthanian either, I take it. Any Shangi? Caraguan?"
Cade shook his head. They were far-off countries he'd only heard of in stories. The very sound of them impressed him. Rafa put the letters down and waved at a bunk, and Cade settled himself uneasily next to one of the thugs.
"So, what can this humble pirate do for you?"
Cade swallowed and asked what he'd come to ask. "I have to get out of the mine." Rafa considered Cade, eyes shrewd in his weathered face, one hand absently tugging his knotty black beard.
"That's quite an ask, brother. Lot of people want to get out of the mine."
"You don't, though," Cade thought. Rafa took whatever duty he felt like, but even with all the easy jobs on offer, he sometimes chose the mine. Rumour had it he just did it for the exercise. There were lots of rumours about Rafa, and if even half were true, then he was mad enough for Cade to believe it.
"I'm thinking you could put me in the workshop," Cade said, his voice small. I'm a carpenter's son. I've got some skill with wood."
"Not much, but some."
"I'd do a good job," he added lamely.
The man next to him chuckled.
"Brother," said Rafa, "it's not about how good you are. You could be Athras the Carver himself, and it wouldn't be a corn husk and a wheat pile to me. Question is, what can you do for me in return?"
Cade's palms were sweating and his throat was dry.
"I could make you things. Stuff you could use. Reckon I could be your eyes on the inside, tell you what's going on in there."
He saw from the look on Rafa's face that he was cutting no ice, and he began to feel desperate. He'd hoped merit alone might win him a place, but he hadn't thought what to say if it didn't. Plans were never his strong suit. It was always Aaron who led the way.
"What do you want?" he blurted at last. "I'll do whatever you need."
"I'm hard-pressed thinking what you can do," said Rafa,
with an apologetic tilt of the shoulder.
"I'm not wanting for much within these walls. So if you can't do me no good in here, what can you do on the outside?"
Cade floundered.
I ain't sure what you mean."
"Any rich relatives who'll pay on your behalf? Failing that, I'll take a favour. Someone in a position of influence, someone who knows something juicy, someone who can get my people on the outside somewhere they couldn't get otherwise."
He clasped his calloused hands together.
"Someone I can use."
Cade struggled to think of anyone who had money, influence, or any kind of special access to anywhere. But that wasn't his world.
"I'm a carpenter's son,"